close. Closer than he had ever been, by the gods. In spite of his extreme dehydration, his hands felt faintly moist, greasy.
"There's some dried meat," the boy said.
"All right," the gunslinger nodded. "Good." The boy got up to fetch it, his knees popping slightly. He made a fine, straight figure. The desert had not yet sapped him. His arms were thin, but the skin, although tanned, had not dried and cracked. "He's got juice," the gunslinger thought. "Mayhap some sand in his craw as well, or he would have taken one of my guns and shot me right where I lay." Or perhaps the boy simply hadn't thought of it. The gunslinger drank from the can again. Sand in his craw or not, he didn't come from this place. Jake came back with a pile of dried jerky on what looked like a sun-scoured breadboard. The meat was tough, stringy, and salty enough to make the cankered lining of the gunslinger's mouth sing. He ate and drank until he felt logy, and then settled back. The boy ate only a little, picking at the dark strands with an odd delicacy. The gunslinger regarded him, and the boy looked back at him candidly enough. "Where did you come from, Jake?" he asked finally.
"I don't know." The boy frowned. "I did know. I knew when I came here, but it's all fuzzy now, like a bad dream when you wake up. I have lots of bad dreams. Mrs. Shaw used to say it was because I watched too many horror movies on Channel 11.
"What's a channel?" A wild idea occurred to him. "Is it like a beam?"
"No. It's TV."
"What's TV?"
The boy touched his forehead. "Pictures."
"Did somebody tote you here, this Mrs. Shaw?"
"No," the boy said. "I just was here."
"Who is Mrs. Shaw?"
"I don't know."
"Why did she call you Bama?"
"I don't remember."
"You're not making any sense," the gunslinger said flatly. Quite suddenly, the boy was on the verge of tears.
"I can't help it. I was just here. If you asked me about TV and channels yesterday, I bet I still could have remembered. Tomorrow, I probably won't even remember I'm Jake. Not unless you tell me, and you won't be here, will you? You're going to go away and I'll starve because you ate up almost all my food. I didn't ask to be here. I don't like it. It's spooky."
"Don't feel so sorry for yourself. Make do."
"I didn't ask to be here,"
the boy repeated with bewildered defiance. The gunslinger ate another piece of the meat. Chewing the salt out of it before swallowing, the boy had become part of it, and the gunslinger was convinced he told the truth. He had not asked for it. It was too bad. He had asked for it. But he had not asked for the game to become this dirty. He had not asked to turn his guns on the townsfolk of Tull. Had not asked to shoot Allie, with her sadly pretty face at the end, marked by the secret she had finally asked to be let in on, using that word, that 19, like a key in a lock. Had not asked to be faced with a choice between duty and flat-out murder. It was not fair to ring in innocent bystanders and make them speak lines they didn't understand on a strange stage. Allie, he thought, Allie was at least part of this world in her own self-illusory way. But this boy, this goddamned boy. "Tell me what you can remember," he told Jake.
"It's only a little. It doesn't seem to make any sense anymore."
"Tell me. Maybe I can pick up the sense." The boy thought about how to begin. He thought about it very hard.
"There was a place, the one before this one, a high place with lots of rooms and a patio where you could look at tall buildings and water. There was a statue that stood in the water."
"A statue in the water?"
"Yes. A lady with a crown and a torch and, I think, a book."
"Are you making this up?"
"I guess I must be," the boy said hopelessly. "There were things to ride in on the streets, big ones and little ones. The big ones were blue and white. The little ones were yellow, a lot of yellow ones. I walked to school. There were cement paths beside the streets, windows to look in, and more statues wearing clothes. The statues sold the clothes. I know it sounds crazy, but the statues sold the clothes."
The gunslinger shook his head and looked for a lie on the boy's face.
He saw none. "I walked to school," the boy repeated doggedly, "and I had a..."
His eyes tilted, closed, and his lips moved gropingly.
"A brown book bag. I carried a lunch, and I wore..."
The groping again, agonized groping.
"A tie."
"A cravat?"
"I don't know."
The boy's fingers made a slow, unconscious, clinching motion at his throat, one the gunslinger associated with hanging.
"I don't know. It's just all gone."
And he looked away. "May I put you to sleep?" the gunslinger asked.
"I'm not sleepy."
"I can make you sleepy. And I can make you remember." Doubtfully, Jake asked,
"How could you do that?"
"With this." The gunslinger removed one of the shells from his gun belt and twirled it in his fingers. The movement was dexterous, as flowing as oil. The shell cartwheeled effortlessly from thumb and index to index and second to second and ring to ring and pinky. It popped out of sight and reappeared, seemed to float briefly, then reversed. The shell walked across the gunslinger's fingers. The fingers themselves marched as his feet had marched on his last miles to this place. The boy watched, his initial doubt first replaced with plain delight, then by raptness, then by dawning blankness, as he opened. His eyes slipped shut. The shell danced back and forth. Jake's eyes opened again, caught the steady, limpid movement between the gunslinger's fingers a little while longer, and then they closed once more. The gunslinger continued the howken, but Jake's eyes did not open again. The boy breathed with slow and steady calmness. Did this have to be part of it? Yes, it did. There was a certain cold beauty to it, like the lacy frettings that fringe hard blue ice packs. He once more seemed to hear his mother singing, not the nonsense about the rain in Spain this time, but sweeter nonsense coming from a great distance as he rocked on the rim of sleep. "Baby Bunting, baby dear, baby, bring your basket here." Not for the first time, the gunslinger tasted the smooth, loaded taste of soul sickness. The shell in his fingers, manipulated with such unknown grace, was suddenly horrific, the spoor of a monster. He dropped it into his palm, made a fist, and squeezed it with painful force. Had it exploded, in that moment he would have rejoiced at the destruction of his talented hand, for its only true talent was murder. There had always been murder in the world, but telling himself so was no comfort. There was murder, there was rape. There were unspeakable practices, and all of them were for the good, the bloody good, the bloody myth, for the grail, for the tower. Ah, the tower stood somewhere in the middle of things, so they did say, rearing its black-gray bulk to the sky, and in his desert-scoured ears the gunslinger heard the faint, sweet sound of his mother's voice. "Chuzzit, chizzit, chazzit, bring enough to fill your basket." He brushed the song and the sweetness of the song aside. "Where are you?" he asked. 3. Jake Chambers, sometimes Bama, is going downstairs with his book bag. There is earth science, there is geography, there is a notepad, a pencil, a lunch his mother's cook, Mrs. Greta Shaw, has made for him in the chrome and formica kitchen, where a fan whirs eternally, sucking up alien odors. In his lunch sack he has a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, a bologna lettuce and onion sandwich, and 4 Oreo cookies. His parents do not hate him, but they do seem to have overlooked him. They have abdicated and left him to Mrs. Greta Shaw, to nannies, to a tutor in the summer, and the Piper School, which is private and nice, and most of all, white, the rest of the time.
None of these people have ever pretended to be more than what they are. Professional people, the best in their fields. None have folded him to a particularly warm bosom, as usually happens in the historical romance novels his mother reads, and which Jake has dipped into, looking for the hot parts. Hysterical novels, his father sometimes calls them, and sometimes bodice rippers. You should talk, his mother says, with infinite scorn from behind some closed door where Jake listens. His father works for the network, and Jake could pick him out of a lineup of skinny men with crew cuts. Probably. Jake does not know that he hates all the professional people, but Mrs. Shaw. People have always bewildered him. His mother, who is scrawny in a sexy way, often goes to bed with sick friends. His father sometimes talks about people at the network who are doing too much Coca-Cola. This statement is always accompanied by a humorless grin and a quick little sniff of the thumbnail. Now, he's on the street. Jake Chambers is on the street. He has hit the bricks. He is clean and well-mannered, comely, sensitive. He bowls once a week at Midtown Lanes. He has no friends, only acquaintances. He has never bothered to think about this, but it hurts him. He does not know or understand that a long association with professional people has caused him to take on many of their traits. Mrs. Greta Shaw, better than the rest of them, but gosh, is that ever a consolation prize, makes very professional sandwiches. She quarters them and cuts off the bread crusts so that when he eats in the gym period four, he looks like he ought to be at a cocktail party with a drink in his other hand instead of a sports novel or a Clay Blaisdell Western from the school library. His father makes a great deal of money because he is a master of the kill, that is, placing a stronger show on his network against a weaker show on a rival network. His father smokes four packs of cigarettes a day. His father does not cough, but he has a hard grin, and he's not averse to the occasional shot of the old Coca-Cola. Down the street. His mother leaves cab fare, but he walks every day it doesn't rain, swinging his book bag and sometimes his bowling bag, although mostly he leaves it in his locker, a small boy who looks very American with his blonde hair and blue eyes. Girls have already begun to notice him, with their mother's approval, and he does not shy away with skittish little boy arrogance. He talks to them with unknowing professionalism and puzzles them away. He likes geography and bowling in the afternoon. His father owns stock in a company that makes automatic pin-setting machinery, but Midtown Lanes does not use his father's brand. He does not think he has thought about this, but he has. Walking down the street, he passes Bloomie's, where the models stand dressed in fur coats, in six-button Edwardian suits, some in nothing at all, some are bare-naked. These models, these mannequins, are perfectly professional, and he hates all professionalism. He is too young to have learned to hate himself yet, but that seed is already there. Given time, it will grow and bear bitter fruit. He comes to the corner and stands with his book bag at his side. Traffic roars by, grunting blue and white buses, yellow taxis, Volkswagens, a large truck. He is just a boy, but not average. And he sees the man who kills him out of the corner of his eye. It is the man in black. And he doesn't see the face, only the swirling robe, the outstretched hands, and the hard, professional grin. He falls into the street with his arms outstretched, not letting go of the book bag which contains Mrs. Greta Shaw's extremely professional lunch. There is a brief glance through a polarized windshield at the horrified face of a businessman wearing a dark blue hat, in the band of which is a small, jaunty feather. Somewhere, a radio is blasting rock and roll. An old woman on the far curb screams. She's wearing a black hat with a net. Nothing jaunty about that black net. It is like a mourner's veil. Jake feels nothing but surprise, and his usual sense of headlong bewilderment. Is this how it ends? before he's bowled better than 270? He lands hard in the street and looks at an asphalt-sealed crack some 2 inches from his eyes. The book bag is jolted from his hand. He is wondering if he has skinned his knees when the car belonging to the businessman wearing the blue hat with the jaunty feather passes over him. It is a big blue 1976 Cadillac with white-walled Firestone tires. The car is almost exactly the same color as the businessman's hat. It breaks Jake's back, mushes his guts to gravy, and sends blood from his mouth in a high-pressure jet. He turns his head and sees the Cadillac's flaming taillights and smoke spurting from beneath its locked rear wheels. The car has also run over his book bag and left a wide black tread on it. He turns his head the other way and sees a large gray Ford screaming to a stop inches from his body. A black fellow who has been selling pretzels and sodas from a pushcart is coming toward him on the run. Blood runs from Jake's nose, ears, eyes, rectum. His genitals have been squashed. He wonders irritably how badly he has skinned his knees. He wonders if he'll be late for school. Now the driver of the Cadillac is running toward him, babbling. Somewhere, a terrible, calm voice, the voice of doom, says, "I am a priest. Let me through. An act of contrition." He sees the black robe and knows sudden horror. It is him, the man in black. Jake turns his face away with the last of his strength. Somewhere, a radio is playing a song by the rock group Kiss. He sees his own hand trailing on the pavement, small, white, shapely. He has never bitten his nails. Looking at his hand, Jake dies. 4. The gunslinger hunkered in frowning thought. He was tired and his body ached, and the thoughts came with aggravating slowness. Across from him, the amazing boy slept with his hands folded in his lap, still breathing calmly. He had told his tale without much emotion, although his voice had trembled near the end when he had come to the part about the priest and the act of contrition. He had not, of course, told the gunslinger about his family and his own sense of bewildered dichotomy, but that had seeped through anyway, enough for the gunslinger to make out its shape. The fact that there had never been such a city as the boy described, unless it was the mythic city of Ludd, was not the most upsetting part of the story, but it was disturbing. It was all disturbing. The gunslinger was afraid of the implications. "Jake?"
"Uh-huh."
"Do you want to remember this when you wake up or forget it?"
"Forget it," the boy said promptly. "When the blood came out of my mouth, I could taste my own shit."
"All right. You're going to sleep, understand? Real sleep now. Go ahead and lie over, if it do please you." Jake laid over, looking small and peaceful and harmless. The gunslinger did not believe he was harmless. There was a deadly feeling about him, the stink of yet another trap. He didn't like the feeling, but he liked the boy. He liked him a great deal. "Jake?"
"Shh, I'm sleeping. I want to sleep."
"Yes, and when you wake up, you won't remember any of this."
"Okay. Good."
The gunslinger watched him for a brief time, thinking of his own boyhood, which usually seemed to have happened to another person, to a person who had leaped through some fabulous lens of time to become someone else, but which now seemed poignantly close. It was very hot in the stable of the weigh station, and he carefully drank some more water. He got up and walked to the back of the building, pausing to look into one of the horse stalls. There was a small pile of white hay in the corner, and a neatly folded blanket, but there was no smell of horse. There was no smell of anything in the stable. The sun had bled away every smell and left nothing. The air was perfectly neutral. At the back of the stable was a small, dark room with a stainless steel machine in the center. It was untouched by rust or rot. It looked like a butter churn.
At the left, a chrome pipe jutted from it, terminating over a drain in the floor. The gunslinger had seen pumps like it in other dry places, but never one so big. He could not contemplate how deep they must have drilled before they struck water, secret and forever black under the desert. Why hadn't they removed the pump when the way station had been abandoned? Demons, perhaps. He shuddered abruptly, an abrupt twisting of his back. Heat flesh poked out on his skin, then receded. He went to the control switch and pushed the on button. The machine began to hum. After perhaps half a minute, a stream of cool, clear water belched from the pipe and went down the drain to be recirculated. Perhaps 3 gallons flowed out of the pipe before the pump shut itself down with a final click. It was a thing as alien to this place and time as true love, and yet as concrete as a judgment, a silent reminder of the time when the world had not yet moved on. It probably ran on an atomic slug, as there was no electricity within 1,000 miles of here, and even dry batteries would have lost their charge long ago. It had been made by a company called North Central Positronics. The gunslinger didn't like it. He went back and sat down beside the boy, who had put one hand under his cheek. Nice-looking boy. The gunslinger drank some more water and crossed his legs, so he was sitting Indian fashion. The boy, like the squatter on the edge of the desert who kept the bird, Zoltan, the gunslinger remembered abruptly, the bird's name was Zoltan, had lost his sense of time. But the fact that the man in black was closer seemed beyond doubt. Not for the first time, the gunslinger wondered if the man in black was letting him catch up for some reason of his own. Perhaps the gunslinger was playing into his hands. He tried to imagine what the confrontation might be like, and could not. He was very hot, but no longer felt sick. The nursery rhyme occurred to him again, but this time, instead of his mother, he thought of Court. Court, an ageless engine of a man, his face stitched with the scars of bricks and bullets and blunt instruments, the scars of war and instruction in the arts of war. He wondered if Court had ever had a love to match those monumental scars. He doubted it. He thought of Susan and his mother and of Martin, that incomplete enchanter. The gunslinger was not a man to dwell on the past, only a shadowy conception of the future and of his own emotional makeup saved him from being a man without imagination, a dangerous dullard. His present run of thought, therefore, rather amazed him. Each name called up others. Cuthbert, Alan, the old man Jonas with his quavery voice. And again, Susan, the lovely girl at the window. Such thoughts always came back to Susan and the great rolling plain known as the Drop, and fishermen casting their nets in the bays on the edge of the clean sea. The piano player in Tull, also dead, all dead in Tull, and by his hand, had known those places, although he and the gunslinger had only spoken of them that once. Sheb had been fond of the old songs, had once played them in a saloon called The Traveler's Rest, and the gunslinger hummed one tunelessly under his breath.
Love, oh careless love, see what careless love has done.
The gunslinger laughed, bemused. I am the last of that green and warm-hued world. And for all his nostalgia, he felt no self-pity. The world had moved on mercilessly. But his legs were still strong, and the man in black was closer. The gunslinger nodded out. Five. When he awoke, it was almost dark, and the boy was gone. The gunslinger got up, hearing his joints pop, and went to the stable door. There was a small flame dancing in darkness on the porch of the inn. He walked toward it, his shadow long and black and trailing in the reddish ochre light of sunset. Jake was sitting by a kerosene lamp. "The oil was in a drum," he said, "but I was scared to burn it in the house, everything's so dry."
"You did just right."
The gunslinger sat down, seeing but not thinking about the dust of years that puffed up around his rump. He thought it something of a wonder that the porch didn't simply collapse beneath their combined weight. The flame from the lamp shadowed the boy's face with delicate tones. The gunslinger produced his poke and rolled a cigarette.
"We have to palaver," he said.
Jake nodded, smiling a little at the word.
"I guess you know I'm on the prod for that man you saw."
"Are you going to kill him?"
"I don't know. I have to make him tell me something. I may have to make him take me someplace."
"Where?"
"To find a tower," the gunslinger said.
He held his cigarette over the chimney of the lamp and drew on it. The smoke drifted away on the rising night breeze. Jake watched it. His face showed neither fear nor curiosity, certainly not enthusiasm.
"So I'm going on tomorrow," the gunslinger said. "You'll have to come with me. How much of that meat is left?"
"Only a little."
"Corn?"
"A little more."
The gunslinger nodded. "Is there a cellar?"
"Yes."
Jake looked at him. The pupils of his eyes had grown to a huge, fragile size.
"You pull up on a ring in the floor, but I didn't go down. I was afraid the ladder would break and I wouldn't be able to get up again. And it smells bad. It's the only thing around here that smells at all."
"We'll get up early and see if there's anything down there worth taking. Then we'll go."
"All right." The boy paused and then said, "I'm glad I didn't kill you when you were sleeping. I had a pitchfork and I thought about doing it, but I didn't. And now I won't have to be afraid to go to sleep."
"What would you be afraid of?"
The boy looked at him ominously. "Spooks. Of him coming back."
"The man in black,"
the gunslinger said. "Not a question."
"Yes. Is he a bad man?"
"I guess that depends on where you're standing," the gunslinger said absently.
He got up and pitched his cigarette out onto the hardpan.
"I'm going to sleep."
The boy looked at him timidly. "Can I sleep in the stable with you?"
"Of course."
The gunslinger stood on the steps, looking up, and the boy joined him. Old Star was up there, and Old Mother. It seemed to the gunslinger that if he closed his eyes, he would be able to hear the croaking of the first spring peepers, smell the green, almost summer smell of the court lawns after their first cutting, and hear, perhaps, the indolent click of wooden balls as the ladies of the east wing, attired only in their shifts as dusk glimmered toward dark, played at points. Could almost see Cuthbert and Jamie as they came through the break in the hedges, calling for him to ride out with them. It was not like him to think so much of the past. He turned back and picked up the lamp.
"Let's go to sleep," he said.
They crossed to the stable together.
Six. The next morning, he explored the cellar. Jake was right, it smelled bad. It had a wet, swampy stench that made the gunslinger feel nauseous and a little lightheaded after the antiseptic odorlessness of the desert in the stable. The cellar smelled of cabbages and turnips and potatoes with long, sightless eyes gone to everlasting rot. The ladder, however, seemed quite sturdy, and he climbed down. The floor was earthen, and his head almost touched the overhead beams. Down here, spiders still lived, disturbingly big ones with mottled gray bodies. Many were muties, the true thread long lost. Some had eyes on stalks, some had what might have been as many as 16 legs. The gunslinger peered around and waited for his night eyes.
"You all right?"
Jake called down nervously.
Yes. He focused on the corner. There are cans. Wait.
He went carefully to the corner, ducking his head. There was an old box with one side folded down. The cans were vegetables, green beans, yellow beans, and 3 cans of corned beef. He scooped up an armload and went back to the ladder. He climbed halfway up and handed them to Jake, who knelt to receive them. He went back for more. It was on the third trip that he heard the groaning in the foundations. He turned, looked, and felt a kind of dreamy terror wash over him, a feeling both languid and repellent. The foundation was composed of huge sandstone blocks that had probably been evenly cornered when the way station was new, but which were now at every zigzag, drunken angle. It made the wall look as if it were inscribed with strange, meandering hieroglyphics. And from the joining of 2 of these abstruse cracks, a thin spall of sand was running, as if something on the other side was digging itself through with slobbering, agonized intensity. The groaning rose and fell, becoming louder, until the whole cellar was full of the sound, an abstract noise of ripping pain and dreadful effort.
"Come up!" Jake screamed. "Oh, Jesus, mister, come up!"
"Go away!" the gunslinger said calmly. "Wait outside. If I don't come up by the time you count to 300, get the hell out."
"Come up!"
Jake screamed again. The gunslinger didn't answer. He pulled leather with his right hand. There was a hole as big as a coin in the wall now. He could hear, through the curtain of his own terror, Jake's pattering feet as the boy ran. Then the spill of sand stopped. The groaning ceased, but there was a sound of steady, labored breathing. "Who are you?" the gunslinger asked. No answer. And in the high speech, his voice filling with the old thunder of command, Roland demanded, "Who are you, demon? Speak if you would speak. My time is short, my patience shorter."
"Go slow,"
a dragging, clotted voice said from within the wall. And the gunslinger felt the dreamlike terror deepen and grow almost solid. It was the voice of Alice, the woman he had stayed with in the town of Tull, but she was dead. He had seen her go down himself, a bullet hole between her eyes. Fathoms seemed to swim by his eyes, descending.
"Go slow past the drawers, gunslinger. Watch for the Tyene. While you travel with the boy, the man in black travels with your soul in his pocket."
"What do you mean? Speak on!" But the breathing was gone. The gunslinger stood for a moment, frozen. And then one of the huge spiders dropped on his arm and scrambled frantically up to his shoulder. With an involuntary grunt, he brushed it away and got his feet moving. He did not want to do the next thing, but custom was strict, inviolable. "Take the dead from the dead," the old proverb said. Only a corpse may speak true prophecy. He went to the hole and punched at it. The sandstone crumbled easily at the edges, and with a bare stiffening of muscles, he thrust his hand through the wall and touched something solid, with raised and fretted knobs. He drew it out. He held a jawbone, rotted at the far hinge. The teeth leaned this way and that.
"All right,"
he said softly. He thrust it rudely into his back pocket and went back up the ladder, carrying the last cans awkwardly. He left the trapdoor open. The sun would get in and kill the muty spiders. Jake was halfway across the stable yard, cowering on the cracked, rubbly hardpan. He screamed when he saw the gunslinger, backed away a step or two, and then ran to him, crying.
"I thought it got you, that it got you. I thought—"
"It didn't. Nothing got me."
He held the boy to him, feeling his face hot against his chest and his hands dry against his ribcage. He could feel the rapid beating of the boy's heart. It occurred to him later that this was when he began to love the boy, which was, of course, what the man in black must have planned all along. Was there ever a trap to match the trap of love?
"Was it a demon?"
The voice was muffled.
Yes, a speaking demon. We don't have to go back there anymore. Come on, let's shake a mile.
They went to the stable, and the gunslinger made a rough pack from the blanket he'd slept under. It was hot and prickly, but there was nothing else. That done, he filled the water bags from the pump. You carry one of the water bags, the gunslinger said. Wear it around your shoulders, see?
Yes.
The boy looked up at him worshipfully, the look quickly masked. He slung one of the bags over his shoulders. Is it too heavy?
No, it's fine.
Tell me the truth now. I can't carry you if you get a sunstroke.
I won't have a sunstroke. I'll be okay.
The gunslinger nodded.
We're going to the mountains, aren't we?
Yes.
They walked out into the steady smash of the sun. Jake, his head as high as the swing of the gunslinger's elbows, walked to his right and a little ahead, the rawhide-wrapped ends of the water bag hanging nearly to his shins. The gunslinger had crisscrossed two more water bags across his shoulders and carried the sling of food in his armpit, his left arm holding it against his body. In his right hand was his pack, his poke, and the rest of his gunner. They passed through the far gate of the way station and found the blurred ruts of the stage track again. They had walked perhaps 15 minutes when Jake turned around and waved at the two buildings. They seemed to huddle in the titanic space of the desert.
Goodbye,
Jake cried.
Goodbye.
Then he turned back to the gunslinger, looking troubled.
I feel like something's watching us.
Something or someone,
the gunslinger agreed.
Was someone hiding there? Hiding there all along?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Should we go back?
Go back and... No. We're done with that place.
Good,
Jake said fervently. They walked. The stage track breasted a frozen sand drumlin, and when the gunslinger looked around, the way station was gone. Once again, there was the desert, and that only. 7. They were 3 days out of the way station. The mountains were deceptively clear now. They could see the smooth, stepped rise of the desert into foothills, the first naked slopes, the bedrock bursting through the skin of the earth in sullen, eroded triumph. Further up, the land gentled off briefly again, and for the first time in months or years, the gunslinger could see real, living green. Grass, dwarf spruces, perhaps even willows, all fed by snow runoff from further up. Beyond that, the rock took over again, rising in cyclopean, tumbled splendor all the way to the blinding snowcaps. Off to the left, a huge slash showed the way to the smaller, eroded sandstone cliffs and mesas and buttes on the far side. This draw was obscured in the almost continual gray membrane of showers. At night, Jake would sit fascinated for the few minutes before he fell into sleep, watching the brilliant swordplay of the far-off lightning, white and purple, startling in the clarity of the night air. The boy was fine on the trail. He was tough, but more than that, he seemed to fight exhaustion with a calm reservoir of will which the gunslinger appreciated and admired. He didn't talk much, and he didn't ask questions, not even about the jawbone, which the gunslinger turned over and over in his hands during his evening smoke. He caught a sense that the boy felt highly flattered by the gunslinger's companionship, perhaps even exalted by it, and this disturbed him. The boy had been placed in his path. While you travel with the boy, the man in black travels with your soul in his pocket. And the fact that Jake was not slowing him down only opened the way to more sinister possibilities. They passed the symmetrical campfire leavings of the man in black at regular intervals, and it seemed to the gunslinger that these leavings were much fresher now. On the third night, the gunslinger was sure that he could see the distant spark of another campfire somewhere in the first rising swell of the foothills. This did not please him as much as he once might have believed. One of Court's sayings occurred to him. Where the man who fakes a limp. Near 2 o'clock on the fourth day out from the way station, Jake reeled and almost fell. Here, sit down, the gunslinger said.
No, I'm okay.
Sit down. The boy sat obediently. The gunslinger squatted close by so Jake would be in his shadow. Drink.
I'm not supposed to until...
Drink. The boy drank 3 swallows. The gunslinger wet the tail of the blanket, which held a good deal less now, and applied the damp fabric to the boy's wrists and forehead, which were fever dry. From now on, we rest every afternoon at this time. 15 minutes. Do you want to sleep?
No.
The boy looked at him with shame. The gunslinger looked back blandly. In an abstracted way, he withdrew one of the bullets from his belt and began to twirl it, Hauken, between his fingers. The boy watched, fascinated.
That's neat, he said.
The gunslinger nodded. Yar. He paused. When I was your age, I lived in a walled city. Did I tell you that? The boy shook his head sleepily. Sure. And there was an evil man.
The priest?
Well, sometimes I wonder about that, tell you true, the gunslinger said. If they were two, I think now they must have been brothers. Maybe even twins. But did I ever see them together? No, I never did. This bad man, this Martin, he was a wizard, like Merlin. Do they ken Merlin, where you come from?
Merlin and Arthur, and the Knights of the Round Table,
Jake said dreamily. The gunslinger felt a nasty jolt go through him. Yes, he said. Arthur Eld, you say true. I say thank you. I was very young. But the boy was asleep, sitting up, his hands folded neatly in his lap. Jake.
Yar.
The sound of this word from the boy's mouth startled him badly, but the gunslinger wouldn't let his voice show it. When I snap my fingers, you'll wake up. You'll be rested and fresh. Do you ken it?
Yes.
Lie over, then. The gunslinger got makings from his poke and rolled a cigarette. There was something missing. He searched for it in his diligent, careful way and located it. The missing thing was his previous maddening sense of hurry, the feeling that he might be left behind at any time, that the trail would die out and he would be left with only a last, fading footprint. All that was gone now, and the gunslinger was slowly becoming sure that the man in black wanted to be caught. Where the man who fakes a limp? What would follow? The question was too vague to catch his interest. Cuthbert would have found interest in it, lively interest, and probably a joke. But Cuthbert was as gone as the horn of this chain, and the gunslinger could only go forward in the way he knew. He watched the boy as he smoked, and his mind turned back on Cuthbert, who had always laughed, to his death he had gone laughing, and Court, who never laughed, and on Martin, who sometimes smiled, a thin, silent smile that had its own disquieting gleam, like an eye that slips open in the dark and discloses blood. And there had been the falcon, of course. The falcon was named David, after the legend of the boy with the sling. David, he was quite sure, knew nothing but the need for murder, rending, and terror, like the gunslinger himself. David was no dilettante. He played the center of the court. Except maybe at the end. The gunslinger's stomach seemed to rise painfully against his heart, but his face didn't change. He watched the smoke of his cigarette rise into the hot desert air and disappear. And his mind went back. 8. The sky was white. Perfectly white, The smell of rain, strong in the air, the smell of hedges and growing green was sweet. It was deep spring, what some called new earth. David sat on Cuthbert's arm, a small engine of destruction, with bright golden eyes that glared outward at nothing. The rawhide leash, attached to his jesses, was looped carelessly about Bert's arm. Court stood aside from the two boys, a silent figure in patched leather trousers and a green cotton shirt that had been cinched high with his old, wide infantry belt. The green of his shirt, merged with the hedges and the rolling turf of the back courts where the ladies had not yet begun to play at points.
"Get ready," Roland whispered to Cuthbert.
"We're ready," Cuthbert said confidently. "Aren't we, Davy?"
They spoke the low speech, the language of both scullions and squires. The day when they would be allowed to use their own tongue in the presence of others was still far.
"It's a beautiful day for it. Can you smell the rain? It's—"
Court abruptly raised the trap in his hands and let the side fall open. The dove was out and up, trying for the sky in a quick, fluttering blast of its wings. Cuthbert pulled the leash, but he was slow. The hawk was already up, and his takeoff was awkward. The hawk recovered with a brief twitch of its wings. It struck upward, trudging the air, gaining altitude over the dove, moving bullet swift. Court walked over to where the boys stood, casually, and swung his huge and twisted fist at Cuthbert's ear. The boy fell over without a sound, although his lips writhed back from his gums. A trickle of blood flowed slowly from his ear and onto the rich green grass.
"You were slow, maggot," he said.
Cuthbert was struggling to his feet.
"I cry your pardon, Court. It's just that I—"
Court swung again, and Cuthbert fell over again. The blood flowed more swiftly now.
"Speak the high speech," he said softly. His voice was flat, with a slight drunken rasp. "Speak your act of contrition in the speech of civilization for which better men than you will ever be have died, maggot."
Cuthbert was getting up again. Tears stood brightly in his eyes, but his lips were pressed together in a tight line of hate which did not quiver.
"I grieve," Cuthbert said in a voice of breathless control. "I have forgotten the face of my father, whose guns I hope someday to bear."
"That's right, brat," Court said. "You'll consider what you did wrong, and sharpen your reflections with hunger. No supper, no breakfast."
"Look," Roland cried. He pointed up.
The hawk had climbed above the soaring dove. It glided for a moment, its stubby wings outstretched and without movement on the still white spring air. Then it folded its wings and dropped like a stone. The two bodies came together, and for a moment Roland fancied he could see blood in the air. The hawk gave a brief scream of triumph. The dove fluttered, twisting, to the ground, and Roland ran toward the kill, leaving Court and the chastened Cuthbert behind him. The hawk had landed beside its prey and was complacently tearing into its plump white breast. A few feathers seesawed slowly downward.
"David!"
the boy yelled, and tossed the hawk a piece of rabbit flesh from his poke. The hawk caught it on the fly, ingested it with an upward shaking of its back and throat, and Roland attempted to releash the bird. The hawk whirled, almost absent-mindedly, and ripped skin from Roland's arm in a long, dangling gash. Then it went back to its meal. With a grunt, Roland looped the leash again, this time catching David's diving, slashing beak on the leather gauntlet he wore. He gave the hawk another piece of meat, then hooded it. Docilely, David climbed onto his wrist. He stood up proudly, the hawk on his arm.
"What's this, can you tell me?"
Court asked, pointing to the dripping slash on Roland's forearm. The boy stationed himself to receive the blow, locking his throat against any possible cry, but no blow fell.
"He struck me," Roland said.
"You pissed him off," Court said. "The hawk does not fear you, boy, and the hawk never will. The hawk is God's gunslinger."
Roland merely looked at Court. He was not an imaginative boy, and if Court had intended to imply a moral, it was lost on him. He went so far as to believe that it might have been one of the few foolish statements he had ever heard Court make.
Cuthbert came up behind them and stuck his tongue out at Court safely on his blind side. Roland did not smile, but nodded to him.
"Go in now,"
Court said, taking the hawk. He turned and pointed at Cuthbert.
"But remember your reflection, maggot, and your fast tonight and tomorrow morning."
"Yes," Cuthbert said, stiltedly formal now. "Thank you for this instructive day."
"You learn," Court said, "but your tongue has a bad habit of lolling from your stupid mouth when your instructor's back is turned. Mayhap the day will come when it and you will learn their respective places."
He struck Cuthbert again, this time solidly between the eyes and hard enough so that Roland heard a dull thud, the sound a mallet makes when a scullion taps a keg of beer. Cuthbert fell backward onto the lawn, his eyes cloudy and dazed at first. Then they cleared, and he stared burningly up at Court, his usual easy grin nowhere to be seen, his hatred unveiled, a pinprick as bright as the dove's blood in the center of each eye. He nodded and parted his lips in a scarifying smile that Roland had never seen.
"Then there's hope for you," Court said. "When you think you can, you come for me, maggot."
"How did you know?" Cuthbert said between his teeth. Court turned toward Roland so swiftly that Roland almost fell back a step, and then both of them would have been on the grass, decorating the new green with their blood.
"I saw it reflected in this maggot's eyes," he said. "Remember it, Cuthbert Allgood. Last lesson for today."
Cuthbert nodded again, the same frightening smile on his face. "I grieve," he said. "I have forgotten the face."
"Cut that shit,"
Court said, losing interest. He turned to Roland.
"Go on now, the both of you. If I have to look at your stupid maggot faces any longer, I'll puke my guts and lose a good dinner."
"Come on," Roland said. Cuthbert shook his head to clear it and got to his feet. Court was already walking down the hill in his squat, bow-legged stride, looking powerful and somehow prehistoric. The shaved and grizzled spot at the top of his head glimmered.
"I'll kill the son of a bitch,"
Cuthbert said, still smiling. A large goose egg, purple and knotted, was rising mystically on his forehead.
"Not you or me," Roland said, suddenly bursting into a grin.
"You can have supper in the West kitchen with me. Cook will give us some. He'll tell Court."
"He's no friend of Court's," Roland said, and then shrugged. "And what if he did?"
Cuthbert grinned back.
"Sure. Right, I always wanted to know how the world looked when your head was on backwards and upside down."
They started back together over the green lawns, casting shadows in the fine, white spring light. 9. The cook in the West kitchen was named Hacks. He stood huge in food-stained whites, a man with a crude oil complexion whose ancestry was a quarter black, a quarter yellow, a quarter from the South Islands, now almost forgotten, the world had moved on, and a quarter God's knew what. He shuffled about three high-ceilinged, steamy rooms like a tractor in low gear, wearing huge, caliph-like slippers. He was one of those quite rare adults who communicate with small children fairly well and who love them all impartially, not in a sugary way, but in a business-like fashion that may sometimes entail a hug, in the same way that closing a big business deal may call for a handshake. He even loved the boys who had begun the way of the gun, although they were different from other children, undemonstrative and always slightly dangerous, not in an adult way, but rather as if they were ordinary children with a slight touch of madness. And Bert was not the first of Court's students whom he had fed on the sly. At this moment he stood in front of his huge, rambling electric stove, one of six working appliances left on the whole estate. It was his personal domain, and he stood there watching the two boys bolt the gravied meat scraps he had produced. Behind, before, and all around, cook boys, scullions, and various underlings rushed through the steaming, humid air, rattling pans, stirring stew, slaving over potatoes and vegetables in nether regions.
In the dimly lit pantry alcove, a washerwoman with a doughy, miserable face and hair caught up in a rag splashed water around on the floor with a mop. One of the scullery boys rushed up with a man from the guards in tow.
"This man, he wants you, Hacks."
"All right." Hacks nodded to the guard, and he nodded back. "You boys," he said, "go over to Maggie. She'll give you some pie, then scat. Don't get me in trouble." Later, they would both remember he'd said that. "Don't get me in trouble." They nodded and went over to Maggie, who gave them huge wedges of pie on dinner plates, but gingerly, as if they were wild dogs that might bite her.
"Let's eat it under stairs," Cuthbert said.
"All right." They sat behind a huge, sweating stone colonnade, out of sight of the kitchen, and gobbled their pie with their fingers. It was only moments later that they saw shadows fall on the far curving wall of the wide staircase. Roland grabbed Cuthbert's arm. "Come on," he said. "Someone's coming." Cuthbert looked up, his face surprised and berry-stained. But the shadow stopped, still out of sight. It was Hacks and the man from the guards. The boys sat where they were. If they moved now, they might be heard. "The good man," the guard was saying.
"Farson?"
"In 2 weeks," the guard replied. "Maybe 3. You have to come with us. There's a shipment from the freight depot." A particularly loud crash of pots and pans and a volley of catcalls directed at the hapless potboy who had dropped them blotted out some of the rest. Then the boys heard the guard finish,
"Poisoned meat."
"Risky. Ask not what the good man can do for you," the guard began. "But what you can do for him," Hacks sighed. "Soldier, ask not." "You know what it could mean," the guard said quietly. "Yeah, and I know my responsibilities to him. You don't need to lecture me. I love him just as you do. Would follow him into the sea if he asked, so I would."
"All right. The meat would be marked for short-term storage in your cold rooms, but you'll have to be quick. You must understand that."
"There are children in Taunton?" the cook asked. It was not really a question.
"Children everywhere," the guard said gently. "It's the children we... and he care about."
"Poisoned meat. Such a strange way to care for children." Hacks uttered a heavy, whistling sigh. "Will they curdle and hold their bellies and cry for their mamas?" "I suppose they will."
"It'll be like a going to sleep," the guard said,
but his voice was too confidently reasonable. "Of course," Hacks said and laughed.
"You said it yourself. Soldier, ask not. Do you enjoy seeing children under the rule of a gun when they could be under his hands, ready to start making a new world?"
Hacks did not reply.
"I go on duty in 20 minutes, the guard said, his voice once more calm. "Give me a joint of mutton, and I'll pinch one of your girls and make her giggle. When I leave, my mutton will give no cramps to your belly, Robeson. Will you?"
But the shadows moved away, and the voices were lost.
"I could have killed them," Roland thought, frozen and fascinated. "I could have killed them both with my knife. Slit their throats like hogs."
He looked at his hands, now stained with gravy and berries, as well as dirt from the day's lessons.
"Roland?"
He looked at Cuthbert. They looked at each other for a long moment in the fragrant semi-darkness, and a taste of warm despair rose in Roland's throat. What he felt might have been a sort of death, something as brutal and final as the death of the dove in the white sky over the games field.
"Hacks?"
he thought, bewildered. "Hacks, who put a poultice on my leg that time?
Hacks?"
And then his mind snapped closed, cutting the subject off. What he saw, even in Cuthbert's humorous, intelligent face, was nothing. Nothing at all. Cuthbert's eyes were flat with Hacks's doom. In Cuthbert's eyes, it had already happened. He had fed them, and they had gone understairs to eat, and then Hacks had brought the guard named Robeson to the wrong corner of the kitchen for their treasonous little tête-à-tête.
Ka had worked as Ka sometimes did, as suddenly as a big stone rolling down a hillside. That was all. Cuthbert's eyes were Gunslinger's eyes. Ten.
Roland's father was only just back from the uplands, and he looked out of place amid the drapes and the chiffon fripperies of the main receiving hall to which the boy had only lately been granted access, as a sign of his apprenticeship. Stephen Deschaine was dressed in black jeans and a blue work shirt. His cloak, dusty and streaked, torn to the lining in one place, was slung carelessly over his shoulder with no regard for the way it and he clashed with the elegance of the room. He was desperately thin, and the heavy handlebar mustache below his nose seemed to weight his head as he looked down at his son. The guns crisscrossed over the wings of his hips hung at the perfect angle for his hands, the worn sandalwood grips looking dull and sleepy in this languid indoor light.
"The head cook," his father said softly. "Imagine it. The tracks that were blown upland at the railhead. The dead stock in Hendrickson. And perhaps even imagine.
He looked more closely at his son.
"It preys on you."
"Like the hawk," Roland said. "It preys on you." He laughed at the startling appropriateness of the image rather than at any lightness in the situation. His father smiled.
"Yes," Roland said. "I guess it preys on me."
"Cuthbert was with you," his father said. "He will have told his father by now."
"Yes."
"He fed both of you and court—"
"Yes."
"And Cuthbert, does it prey on him, do you think?"
"I don't know."
Nor did he care. He was not concerned with how his feelings compared with those of others.
"It preys on you because you feel you've caused a man's death?"
Roland shrugged unwillingly, all at once not content with this probing of his motivations.
"Yet you told." "Why?"
The boy's eyes widened.
"How could I not? Treason was—"
His father waved a hand curtly. "If you did it for something as cheap as a schoolbook idea, you did it unworthily. I would rather see all of Taunton poisoned."
"I didn't," the words jerked out of him violently. "I wanted to kill him, both of them. Liars, black liars, snakes, they—"
"Go ahead."
"They hurt me,"
he finished, defiant.
"They changed something and it hurt. I wanted to kill them for it. I wanted to kill them right there."
His father nodded.
"That's crude, Roland, but not unworthy. Not moral, either, but it is not your place to be moral. In fact,"
he peered at his son, "morals may always be beyond you.
You are not quick like Cuthbert or Vanney's boy. That's all right, though. It will make you formidable."
The boy felt both pleased and troubled by this.
He'll hang."
The boy nodded.
"I want to see it."
The elder Deschaine threw his head back and roared laughter.
"Not as formidable as I thought, or perhaps just stupid."
He closed his mouth abruptly. An arm shot out and grabbed the boy's upper arm painfully. Roland grimaced, but didn't flinch. His father peered at him steadily, and the boy looked back, although it was more difficult than hooding the hawk had been.
"All right," he said. "Li Mei,"
and turned abruptly to go.
"Father?"
"What?"
"Do you know who they were talking about? Do you know who the good man is?"
His father turned back and looked at him speculatively.
"Yes, I think I do."
"If you caught him,"
Roland said in his thoughtful, near-plodding way,
"no one else, like Cook, would have to be neck-popped."
His father smiled thinly.
"Perhaps not for a while, but in the end, someone always has to have his or her neck popped, as you so quaintly put it. The people demand it."
Sooner or later, if there isn't a turncoat, the people make one.
Yes, Roland said, grasping the concept instantly. It was one he never forgot.
But if you got the good man...
No, his father said flatly.
Why not? Why wouldn't that end it?
For a moment his father seemed on the verge of saying why, but then shook his head.
We've talked enough for now, I think. Go out from me.
He wanted to tell his father not to forget his promise when the time came for Hax to step through the trap, but he was sensitive to his father's moods. He put his fist to his forehead, crossed one foot in front of the other, and bowed. Then he went out, closing the door quickly. He suspected that what his father wanted now was to fuck. He was aware that his mother and father did that, and he was reasonably well informed as to how it was done. But the mental picture that always condensed with the thought made him feel both uneasy and oddly guilty. Some years later, Susan would tell him the story of Oedipus, and he would absorb it in quiet thoughtfulness, thinking of the odd and bloody triangle formed by his father, his mother, and by Martin, known in some quarters as Farson, the good man. Or perhaps it was a quadrangle, if one wished to add himself. 11. Gallows Hill was on the Taunton Road, which was nicely poetic. Cuthbert might have appreciated this, but Roland did not. He did appreciate the splendidly ominous scaffold which climbed into the brilliantly blue sky, an angular silhouette which overhung the coach road. The two boys had been let out of morning exercises. Court had read the notes from their fathers laboriously, lips moving, nodding here and there. When he finished with them, he had carefully put the papers away in his pocket. Even here in Gilead, paper was easily as valuable as gold. When these two sheets of it were safe, he'd looked up at the blue-violet dawn sky and nodded again.
"Wait here," he said,
and went toward the leaning stone hut that served him as living quarters. He came back with a slice of rough, unleavened bread, broke it in two, and gave half to each.
"When it's over, each of you will put this beneath his shoes. Mind you do exactly as I say, or I'll clout you into next week."
They had not understood until they arrived, riding double on Cuthbert's gelding. They were the first, fully 2 hours ahead of anyone else, and 4 hours before the hanging. So Gallows Hill stood deserted, except for the rooks and ravens. The birds were everywhere. They roosted noisily on the hard jutting bar that overhung the trap, the armature of death. They sat in a row along the edge of the platform. They jostled for position on the stairs.
"They leave the bodies," Cuthbert muttered, "for the birds."
"Let's go up," Roland said.
Cuthbert looked at him with something like horror.
"Up there? Do you think—"
Roland cut him off with a gesture of his hands.
"We're years early. No one will come." "All right."
They walked slowly toward the gibbet, and the birds took wing, cawing and circling like a mob of angry, dispossessed peasants. Their bodies were flat black against the pure dawn light of the in-world sky. For the first time, Roland felt the enormity of his responsibility in the matter. This wood was not noble, not part of the awesome machine of civilization, but merely warped pine from the forest of Barony, covered with splattered white bird droppings. It was splashed everywhere, stairs, railing, platform, and it stank. The boy turned to Cuthbert with startled, terrified eyes and saw Cuthbert looking back at him with the same expression.
"I can't," Cuthbert whispered. "Ro, I can't watch it."
Roland shook his head slowly. There was a lesson here, he realized. Not a shining thing, but something that was old and rusty and misshapen. It was why their fathers had let them come. And with his usual stubborn and inarticulate doggedness, Roland laid mental hands on whatever it was.
"You can, Bert." "I won't sleep tonight if I do."
"Then you won't," Roland said, not seeing what that had to do with it.
Cuthbert suddenly seized Roland's hand and looked at him with such mute agony that Roland's own doubt came back, and he wished sickly that they had never gone to the West Kitchen that night. His father had been right. Better not to know. Better every man, woman, and child in Taunton dead and stinking than this. But still, whatever the lesson was, rusty, whatever half-buried thing with sharp edges, he would not let it go or give up his grip on it.
"Let's not go up," Cuthbert said. "We've seen everything."
And Roland nodded reluctantly, feeling his grip on that thing, whatever it was, weaken. Court, he knew, would have knocked them both sprawling and then forced them up to the platform step by cursing step and sniffing fresh blood back up their noses and down their throats like salty jam as they went. Court would probably have looped new hemp over the yardarm itself and put the noose around each of their necks in turn, would have made them stand on the trap to feel it, and Court would have been ready to strike them again if either wept or lost control of his bladder. And Court, of course, would have been right. For the first time in his life, Roland found himself hating his own childhood. He wished for the long boots of age. He deliberately pried a splinter from the railing and placed it in his breast pocket before turning away. "Why did you do that?" Cuthbert asked. He wished to answer something swaggering. "Oh, the luck of the gallows." But he only looked at Cuthbert and shook his head. "Just so I'll have it," he said. "Always have it." They walked away from the gallows, sat down, and waited. In an hour or so, the first of the townfolk began to gather, mostly families who had come in broken-down wagons and beat-up buckas, carrying their breakfasts with them, hampers of cold pancakes, folded over fillings of wild pokeberry jam. Roland felt his stomach growl hungrily and wondered again, with despair, where the honor and the nobility was. He had been taught of such things and was now forced to wonder if they had been lies all along or only treasures buried deep by the wise. He wanted to believe that, but it seemed to him that Hacks, in his dirty whites, walking around and around his steaming subterranean kitchen and yelling at the potboys, had more honor than this. He fingered the splinter from the gallows tree with sick bewilderment. Cuthbert lay beside him, with his face drawn, impassive.